With us today is William Adler, a freelance writer based in Austin, Texas, and the author of numerous magazine articles and two books of narrative nonfiction, Molly's Job, A Story of Life and Work on the Global Assembly Line, and Land of Opportunity, One Family's Quest for the American Dream in the Age of Crack. He recently completed a year as a Ted Scripps Fellow in Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado, and is presently at work on a screenplay set in southern Utah during the early years of the Cold War. Welcome to Talking History, Bill Adler.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I just have to say, what a wonderful book you've written in Molly's Job. Now, I've used it in my class, and it was very, very positively embraced by my students.
Thank you. That's really nice to hear. I'm glad that it's of use. That's why I wrote it.
I was wondering if we can start by talking a little bit about the background of the book. What got you interested in writing about globalization from this perspective?
I think because I live in Texas, and in 1992, when NAFTA was really being hotly debated in Congress and in the court of public opinion around the country, Texas is one of those states. Of course, we're a border state, and it was so almost unanimously pro-NAFTA that there were very, very few voices in the state and none of the major newspapers, which were really questioning some of the faults or potential faults of the free trade agreement. And so I started thinking then about a way to really understand NAFTA for myself, because I didn't understand it very well. And I don't think a lot of other people did at that point, and it had yet to go into effect. And so the only way I could really come to terms with it was to write about it from the perspective of the human costs. And that's generally how I am able to sort of deal with with my world, is to take a look at the human consequences and the human costs of public policy issues.
Now, this is, you've written an earlier book on crack, but a very personal approach to understanding the crack trade or the underground drug economy. Maybe you could tie the two books together in some way. At least in my mind, they're tied.
Sure. Well, I mean, first let me say it wasn't that personal approach to crack, but it was in the sense that, again, I wanted to look at what it was like to be in that sort of underground economy. In the same way that I think in Molly's Job, I wanted to understand what it was like for people to lose jobs and to then suffer those consequences. And so for that first book, it was called Land of Opportunity. I focused on one particular family that happened to be in Detroit, which was one of the more hard-bit American cities in the 1980s. And took a look at how they got into that business in the first place and why, and sort of the economic and political undercurrents that led to their decision to get in, and then what happened to them once they did.
In both books, I guess some kind of a desperate condition of workers in many ways, of the working class, is depicted.
I think that's right. And again, for me, I mean, these were both sort of hot-button issues at the time. I got into crack. It was, or at least studying crack, it was not long after the first President Bush went on national television and displayed a little baggie of crack. You might remember that he said the White House got a hold of across the street in Lafayette Park. And, you know, crack was all the rage, and the war on drugs was also all the rage then. And I thought, there's just, again, I mean, almost like Molly's Job, and I haven't really thought about it like that before, so I'm glad you're bringing it out. There was this received wisdom about how these issues should be dealt with in the American media, and I felt that there might be another way to look at it. And so I went at it from the perspective of crack dealers, just like I went at Molly's Job at the perspective of people who were most really directly affected by the free trade agreement.
And one of the things, to turn to Molly's Job specifically, since that's the book we're going to focus on today, one of the things I really enjoyed was how both the beginning, where you sort of are beginning, the end of one job and another, and the beginning of another job, where you're going from Patterson to
Matamoros.
Yeah, to right. Mexico. But also that you bring in Alexander Hamilton. Now, why do you bring in Alexander Hamilton into your story?
Yeah, I suppose that's the amateur historian in me. And I probably should say right off that I am not a historian. I'm a journalist by trade and don't have any advanced training in that field or any other field. But Alexander Hamilton basically invented Patterson, and he did so as the archetypal American town. He went there just before he became Treasury Secretary under George Washington to establish a national manufactory. And this was to be an experiment. And he asked for funding from Congress. Congress denied it. And so he and a bunch of his friends decided to put this together themselves. And it ultimately, the experiment failed. They could never really get it off the ground. But they chose Patterson because it's on the Passaic River, and it was a fine source of hydroelectric power for their cotton mill, which was how the other cotton mills, of course, around the Northeast were powered at that point. And so from the beginning, Patterson was sort of really about dreamers and schemers, and that appealed to me. And then when this particular company started up, the one that Molly worked for, is a company called Universal Manufacturing, and it was started right after World War II by another native son of Patterson, a man named Archie Sergi, who also was really kind of a dreamer and a schemer in his own right.
But there's also an irony that I saw in using Alexander Hamilton, because he was known very much as an economic nationalist with his report on manufacturers. And to begin with an economic nationalist and then to tell the story of globalization, of internationalization of industry, I think there's a beautiful irony that you set up there.
And an irony that I will be happy to admit never occurred to me, Jerry. And that's probably where my lack of training comes in.
Well, certainly to historians reading the book, it was there.
Good. I should just say, well, thank you. And move on. But instead, I top to that. But you're right. I mean, again, as I think about it, that's really that is quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are few heroes in this story. There's sympathy certainly for Molly and Dorothy, and is it Balbina or
Balbina? Right,
Balbina. The three women who are the who basically take on Molly's job at different points in time, but the manufacturers, the investment bankers, the speculators, the government, even the trade unions don't come off very well in your book, do they?
No, they don't. There was really only one hero in this book, and he's not all that prominent in the book. He figures in the middle portion, and he was a German emigre named Siegfried Steinberger, who started off working for Universal Manufacturing up in Patterson. He was one of the early employees of the company. And then when Universal decided to open its second plant down in rural Mississippi in 1960, well, the plant opened in 63, the owner sent Mr. Steinberger down there as the plant's first general manager. And at that time in Mississippi, of course, the entire state was, well, the entire South was segregated, and in Mississippi they had a state law that any new industry would have to hire its employees through the State Employment Security Commission, thereby ensuring a segregated workforce, or really an all-white workforce. And Steinberger, to his credit and to the owner Archie Sergi's credit, said no. They didn't say that initially, but ultimately that's what happened. And when the architect for the new plant wanted to he drew plans and he put in white and colored bathrooms. And again, Mr. Steinberger and Mr. Sergi said no. And then later on, and I won't go into all the detail here, but when the employees did start to organize this plant, Mr. Steinberger kind of made it known that he was not opposed to union organizing down there, although because the state was so heavily anti-union and the local fathers, local government was as well, he sort of had to keep his mouth closed about that initially.
That's one of the beauties of this book, is that it really does personalize these global phenomena, the transformations that were taking place in this country in the post-World War II era and into the present by giving us these profiles of plant managers, of workers, and of also speculators like Michael Milken. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the role of investment bankers and corporate raiders.
Yeah, I mean, this company was picked up and spun around so many times and bought and sold that it was quite difficult actually for me to get a handle on initially. But basically what happened was on Wall Street in the 80s, your listeners who've been around for a while might recall that it was really a time of merger mania during the Reagan era and again during the first Bush era. And one of the key players was a fellow named Michael Milken, who worked for the big firm Drexel Burnham Lambert, which is no longer in business. But he was the head of their so-called junk bond department. And it was a low-grade investment bond. And he had various protégés around the country. And one of the things they liked to do was to buy companies, spin off some of the better assets, or keep the better assets and spin off other ones, and just buy and sell these companies like they were playing cards or some board game. And Universal Manufacturing got caught up in this once the original owner, Archie Sergi, died in the 60s, and a couple of big conglomerates took it over. And then finally in the mid-80s, I think it was 1986, one of Milken's proteges got a hold of it through funding by Milken's firm, Drexel Burnham. And he bought and sold it, and then another guy bought and sold it, until finally a new company called Magnatech, a Fortune 500 firm, got a hold of it, and that's when things really started going south, literally and figuratively, for Universal Manufacturing.
Now, in the when they do move south, though, there's a whole other drama that opens up. That's part three of your book. And what are the various players in that particular drama? Who are the various players?
Well, what happened was, again, this actually predates NAFTA, which did not go into effect until the 1st of January of 1994. But for years before that, for decades, actually, American firms had been operating within a 25-mile limit on the Mexican side of the border. There were plenty of American firms, some big ones, Ford and Zenith, and bunches of other ones. And Magnatech, which had renamed Universal Manufacturing, I think it initially was Universal, a Magnatech division or something, but then it just became Magnatech, decided to open up in Mexico. And when they did that, they closed the Patterson plant. And this goes back to Molly James, who had worked there from 1955, I believe, until the plant closed in 1989. My dates are a little rusty now in my head, but I think those dates are right. 35 years, almost 35 years. And they asked her actually to go to Mexico and help train the new employees, and she said, no, I wasn't going to do that. So once in Mexico, they needed to hire a whole new workforce, and what they did was they moved the plant machinery, basically whole, right out of the Patterson plant into the Matamoros, Mexico plant, which is right across the border from Brownsville, Texas, I should add. And so eventually, they hired a young woman named Balbina Duque, who was a 21-year-old at the time, who had never had any experience, who grew up, I mean, the parallels between her life and Molly's life I found absolutely striking, and I can talk about that if you like.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So did my students, by the way.
Oh, okay. I finally discovered one thing I found for myself. Balbina had grown up in south central Mexico in a rural farm town, outside the farm town. Just as Molly had grown up in Virginia, in central Virginia, in a tobacco growing area. And it was a Jim Crow area, of course, like the rest of the South. And there were just no economic opportunities for blacks. This is right after the war, right after World War II. And so as a 19-year-old, Molly took a train, what they used to call the Chicken Bone Special, because it was mostly populated at that point by young African Americans just like her, heading north to find a job. And they would eat fried chicken on the train and leave the bones behind. She came north to New York and then finally to Paterson, where she knew a young man who would become her husband, who had grown up also in the same town in Virginia, and ultimately found work in a thriving Paterson at that point in the early and middle 1950s. And 30 years later, or 40 years later, really, Balbina did the same thing, although she took a bus, a midnight bus from her little town in south central Mexico to the border also to find work. And that they, you know, she ended up working the exact same piece of machinery that Molly had for all those years.
That's, I'm just taken by the characters in this book. One, I should tell you more about the reactions of my students to the book. I think there are several comments about the fact that it wasn't written by an academic and how they began reading it with a little bit of suspicion, really, of the ability of a non-academic to really do justice to the story of globalization.
And Jerry, let me just say that I began writing it with that same suspicion.
Yeah. And then they read it, and you know, they're not used to books without footnotes, especially when, not in an academic course. But as they read it, they were just absolutely struck by their blending of so many different stories together, and the ability to make these general phenomena very personal, and they felt the whole class felt it really worked. It really worked as a book, and I should use it every year. So
let's hope it stays in print a while then.
Oh, yeah, I hope so too. If not, we'll just have to buy used copies of it.
Yeah, well, that's
but
right.
And there many of them are, I should go to another theme here, because it's a good transition, because it deals with the reaction of my students and one of the themes in the book. And that is the, obviously many of my students, this was in the course of a semester course on labor history, work and society.
Is it graduate students or undergrad?
Graduate students.
Uh-huh.
And they're quite sympathetic with labor. And yet this book is quite critical of labor. Maybe you can go into a little bit about the reaction of, the reaction of labor unions to globalization and how they dealt with it both in this country and in Mexico.
Okay, well, that's a complicated question, and So I'll try to give you a simple answer. In this country, I think for a long time, initially, unions really had their head in the sand about globalization, and they did not react with nearly the force or the seriousness that the matter warranted. And I think today, most unions, most research departments and most unions would probably acknowledge that fact. I say it's a fact, the theory. What happened in this case was once the plant threatened to leave Paterson, the union was really in a difficult position because it had been a very corrupt local. And again, I'm just speaking about this one plant, but it had been a Teamsters local, and this particular local had been controlled by the infamous Tony Provenzano, Tony Pro, who ran the New Jersey Joint Board with really an iron hand and a corrupt hand as well. And, I mean, they used to run a numbers game out of this particular plant. And that was, I mean, I can't remember how much money they made now, daily or weekly, from the numbers game, but it was a significant amount of money. And basically they saw the employees and their members as cash cows. And Molly James, my title character, was the first African-American steward at Universal Manufacturing and the first female as well. And she eventually resigned because she was just tired of having to deal with the corruption. And plus, union leaders were disappearing, and she had no interest in that. So it was corrupt. It was dangerous. And so they didn't, but they did, you know, they worked well with the management, and they scratched management's back and so forth. But they were not really in a position to stand up for the employees when the company decided to move. So that was the first problem. In Mexico, there were no free trade unions. And this was still the era of the PRI, the one party, one political party in Mexico that had been in power for 70 or 75 years then. And to belong to a labor union, you also had to belong to the PRI. And so a portion of your dues went to the party. And so there were no free unions, and it was very difficult to organize, as you can imagine. I mean, people belonged to unions. And actually, the labor laws in Mexico were pretty good. They were just never enforced. So there was very little that you could do in the way of serious organizing. However, that said, in this one town, Matamoros, which was, I think, a town that was 50,000 people before the maquilas started growing there in the 80s, and just ballooned up to 10 times that, to about 500,000 people that were counted, and then many, many others who were unregistered. We don't really know how many people were in Matamoros, but believe me, it was packed and is packed. But there was the president of the local union there was actually a militant, at least by Mexico standards, and he insisted on higher wages than were being paid at other parts of the border, other border towns. And he used to stand up to the companies, and they always responded by threatening to close in Matamoros and move to more compliant areas. And ultimately, some of them did, and ultimately, actually, Universal has started to do so, or Magnatec has started to do so as well. But the there's not a tidy way for me to summarize.
No, it is a very complex tale, and
yeah.
one of the things I was struck by is how difficult it was for truly independent unionists and unionists who really had the workers' interests in mind to operate within that sort of environment.
Right. If I could just add one more note, because I neglected to talk about Mississippi and the union there. This was an IBEW, local electrical workers, local in Mississippi, and it also refused to allow blacks into the membership initially, even after blacks were allowed to work into the plant. Of course, it's a right-to-work state, but they would not allow blacks to join the union. And, in fact, they intimidated one black fellow who was the husband of Dorothy Carter, who I write about, a guy named Lewis Carter, who wanted to run for president, ultimately did run for president, and he worked in the maintenance department of the company. And the maintenance department was run by the Ku Klux Klan, and they used to fire shotguns across his truck on the way home. They would follow him home at night. He worked second shift, so he would get off at midnight, and they would hound him. But when he started to run for president, he actually developed some support among some of the white workers, and they would follow him. They would caravan home with him and protect him, and eventually was elected the first black president of that local. So that's sort of a little happier story about unions there.
And in part, I suppose the role of Steinberger was quite significant there.
Yeah, I think that was. I mean, he, again, did not actively resist organizing, and he did promote the idea of integration in the plant. And when he did so, he not only helped integrate the plant, and I should have said this earlier, but it was the largest employer in this county, Simpson County, Mississippi, and he really integrated the county. There had never been a single integrated institution before, and of course, Simpson County was not alone in that. But he really pushed things along a lot faster than they probably would have otherwise in that particular county.
Well, besides the individuals, though, and these stories that you tell, of course, there's the role of government that runs through this book. Maybe we can sort of close on by discussing that a bit. What role does government play, both in Mexico and in the U.S., in promoting these global changes?
Yeah, again, we go back to the Reagan administration, or at least I will go back to that at this point, and its Commerce Department. And I would have thought, this is one of the more shocking things to me during the course of the research for this book, But I would have thought that the Commerce Department would be about promoting American jobs, despite what U.S.-based companies might have been doing. And again, that's, a very naive look at things. But in 1986, the Commerce Department sponsored an event in Mexico, in Acapulco, Mexico, called Expo Maquila 86, and it was held at the Hyatt Regency down there. And the purpose of the expo was to invite American firms to consider opening plants in Mexico, opening maquiladoras. And they sent out this brochure, to 39,000 American firms, and it was advertising, you know, the extraordinary business opportunities and benefits of the maquiladora program. And, of course, this outraged many Americans who had been losing their jobs, who were losing their jobs, as well as the politicians in the Rust Belt states and the Midwest and the Northeast. And they took out ads like, why are you moving our jobs to Mexico? And the government rationale, I still don't really understand what the rationale was. But they kept talking about how, you know, if we want to enhance the competitiveness of American jobs, if we want to avoid protectionism, then, you know, this is a way to do it. So, you know, it was through the looking glass entirely. And I guess that, you know, was far from the only thing that that the government did to promote jobs going elsewhere. But this one was particularly egregious, I thought.
And in Mexico?
In Mexico, the government initially, of course, created the maquiladora program there in conjunction with the U.S. I'm trying to think. I mean, other than what the government, in conjunction with the unions there, did to discourage organizing, nothing is coming right to mind as far as such sort of outrageous behavior. I'm sure there was. I just don't remember.
Well, much of this is not necessarily outrageous behavior,
yeah,
so much as just sort of, you know, just what every government has been doing to promote trade or to promote opportunities for industries.
Well, sure.
That's one of the depressing parts of the book. It's very hard to imagine how this system that has been built up over centuries, really, will ever change, or whether it'll be continually the job moving from country to country to country.
Yeah, I do not have a good answer for that question. But, you know, I can tell you, as I'm sure you well know, that Mexico has been steadily losing jobs since my book was published, and it came out in 2000 originally in hardcover. A lot of those jobs, of course, have gone to Asia. First, they went Universal, or Magnatech, opened a plant up the river from Matamoros in a town called Reynosa, Mexico, because it was a few pesos cheaper there, the pay scale, which was, well, that was government-mandated, the minimum wage, of course. And then they've since moved on, and they've moved into China. And I'm sure you're right. I mean, I think they will continue to move. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
I would love to hear some ideas.
Well, there certainly are dozens, hundreds, thousands of stories, very similar stories of jobs migrating the industry around us here in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
There are the carpet industries, the glove industries, the electrical industry,
right,
and they've all followed the pattern of migration to low-wage areas of the globe or the country.
Right.
So this is, it's very... it's been going on for a long time, and it looks like it's going to go on for a much longer time. But you certainly told the story, a very intricate, complex story about the various players involved in that migration. And I really want to thank you for telling us that story.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.